Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our program, Reserve Now. Tonight, CKWE's guest will be Van McGregor, and our topic will be about band management, so please stay tuned. Earlier this week, I interviewed Van McGregor, and right now we will be going to that interview. Van, how long have you been a band manager?
Well, I've been with the community now for over 3 years. I started in the summer of 84. I wasn't a band manager then, I was a band manager in training. And then after about a year or so, the council promoted me and became band manager. So I've been doing band management for 2 years now.
I see. And what is your educational background?
My educational background, well, first of all, I went to high school here in Maniwaki, the Polyvalent. And then after grade 9, I left and went to Ottawa, where I completed high school, my grade 13 at Glebe Collegiate. Following completion of high school, I went to university, to McGill University in Montreal. There I stayed 3 years and completed my Bachelor of Commerce, which is basically a business degree, well suited for the job I'm doing now.
And what made you become interested in becoming to work for the band as a manager?
I think there are a variety of reasons why I came here. While I was going to school, McGill, in the summertime I would return to the reserve to work during the summer. And one of the summers that I was working, I guess about a year or two before I was completed, I worked in finance in the band here at the office. And I guess the chief liked the work that I was doing, and he offered me a position when I had completed that. There's a possibility that they're looking for a band manager, so that was one of the reasons. And also coming back to the community, you know, I feel like you owe something to the community because of the education of the, you know, like education is being paid by the government, but I feel that, you know, it's dollars that have come into the community, and I feel I should return some of my, you know, my learnings to the community and hopefully help the community.
Mm-hmm. Would you explain to me the duties and responsibilities of a band manager?
That's a good question, because there are many duties and responsibilities of a band manager. If you take into consideration the financial budget of our band last year, I was surprised too when I got the results from the auditor. The auditor said that we administered roughly $7.2 million last year. That was from July 86 to June 87. And that's a fair amount of money, especially when you're looking at roughly 50% of that goes to education. And then there's roughly about $1 million in capital, and the rest is the operation and maintenance. It's pretty well hiring people, delivering services such as welfare and economic development, which is another area, and a variety of, in capital we talk about road construction, the police station which we've built, and a variety of the housing construction. All those, well, we're pretty well where construction is involved. That's the and that's the overall responsibility, I guess, as far as accountability. It rests with the band council, but as far as getting things done, making sure projects are done, making sure the funds are spent according to the agreements, that's my responsibility, and making sure the employees of the band are doing their jobs. And that's pretty well, making sure that the funds that are coming here, and making sure that we're getting all the funds and being accountable for all of them. So it's quite a responsibility.
Mm-hmm. And how many programs are you responsible for, and would you please mention a few to our listeners?
I think I sort of touched on that. Like now, it's even greater, because before the financial accountability for the school was being done separately. That, like, we'd get funds for education and we'd just transfer them over to the school and they'd have their own accounting process. But as of this summer, in July, we've taken that over, and that's a fair responsibility, because you're looking at an additional $3 million, which we have to account for. But education, the people at education is the education authority and the director are still responsible for those programs. But as far as financial accountability, it rests here. You know, what I mean by financial accountability is the dollars that do come in and the dollars that leave the office are basically, that's what we're accountable for. And how they're spent is still determined by the education authority and the director. So you're looking at an increase of roughly, you know, the budget for education is around $3 million, so that's really puts a load on us. And this summer, actually, when we will have completed all our capital projects, we're looking at this summer of roughly $1.2 million. We're building 17 houses this summer, which is a fair amount if you're looking at roughly about $30,000 to $35,000 per house. When I speak of 30 to 35, you're looking at those personal contributions. The department gives 24.6 per unit. So there you're looking at quite a few dollars also. And a road construction, the way things came about is that they're shifting more monies in capital to our reserve this year. So we're looking at $1.2 million. We've decided to extend Bidibi Road. So that's another $500,000 spent on that road. It's a lot of money because you're looking at roughly $120,000 per kilometer for road construction. So I'm responsible for that. I have to draft up all the contracts. Take for example that. There's the contracts for paving. There's the contracts for crushing material. Draft those up. Getting the bids for them. There's the whole bidding process. Getting prices. Taking the lowest price. And then after that, once that's agreed upon, you go with the contract, draft of the contracts, and then issue them. And then the follow-up after making sure the work gets done, the testing and everything. So that, right from the start to the very end, is pretty well is what I'm responsible for. Well, anyways, I've pretty well just basically touched on the capital. And one of the things that to bear in mind when we do projects like the road construction and all that, one of the things why, if you look at other communities, why we're doing far better than a lot of other Indian communities, is I think is because we're able to deal with the Department of Indian Affairs bureaucrats. Is like when we do projects like the road construction, for instance, or housing construction, is that when we say we're going to do 15 units of housing construction, we do 15 units and they're completed. It's the same with the road construction. That's a major difference, and I think when it comes to that, the project administration, we have to be realistic about costs. Like in the road construction, like budgets have to be prepared beforehand, and then when you're doing them is that you have to stick with them. Because if you have $500,000 to do road construction, you don't have 600,000, you have 500,000, and you got to work with that amount of money and do it with what you have. And I think as far from an administrative and a business point of view, that's the way things have to be done. And I think if you look at the overall financial situation of the band over the last year for the 86-87 fiscal year. We haven't received their audit report yet, but from what we've done, all the things that were done last year, the band is still in good financial situation here. What I mean by a good financial situation is that we haven't incurred any deficit over the last year. If you look at all the funds that were administered, we're still in a slight surplus. But that's difficult as time goes on because we're handling more, we're doing more with the dollars that we have. And for instance, this court case, which the band is involved in, has cost the community over $120,000 last fiscal year. And where the funds came for that, well, you're looking at interest and other forms, wood revenues. Like I say, that's it's a large responsibility, especially when you have to not only administer the funds, but when you do projects, is to do them within the required funds that you have, but the available funds, not the required funds, but the available funds you have. So that's a bit difficult. And also, I think that seems to be difficult, but I think one of the more demanding parts of the job is dealing with people and making people understand this situation. I think that's one of the hardest things of the job. When I was talking about other programs, because the programs, I just basically explained the capital programs, and the other big programs which we're looking at is the O&M. O&M is pretty well, what you call service delivery. Like we have the school, a large part of the school, this education budget is classified as O&M. Like, as for your information, O&M is like maintaining the school, maintaining the office here, the administration office, maintaining all the buildings. There are certain funds provided for that, and to hire people, to have our administrative staff here, that's all part of O&M. So the government differentiates the two, is that you can't use capital dollars for O&M, and you know, like when people hear us talk, well, we can't do this, we can't do that, it's because there's certain restrictions on the agreements that if you have capital dollars, you have to use them for capital, you can't use them to hire people, and, you know, it's, but anyways, that's on a general, if you're looking at specific programs, it's like I mentioned earlier, we have our police. It's another program, you know, providing police services to the community is an O&M, which we're accountable for. There's the administration of the welfare dollars, which is also another area we're accountable for. And I can go on and on, like the administration of this office is another budget. There's economic development. There's a variety of them. Like offhand, I don't know how many programs we have. You know, when you ask that question, how many programs do you administer? It's a difficult question to ask because there are quite a few. And that's one of the problems, is that the way the government asks us to be accountable, they want us to be accountable to every nickel, dollar, and penny, you know, and when you're looking at a budget of $7.2 million, that's difficult, because you're looking at programs like, right now we have about 60 or 70 programs set up. Like when we have our statement, our revenue and expense statement, it's like 3 pages long of all the programs that we have. And you have to know all the budgets in them and not be out of line with at year end. Let's see what else can I. I think that's pretty well giving you an overall view of the programs that we administer.
Okay, fine. What in your mind is the most important project that you have administered for the River Deserve Band?
There are so many programs year to year that we administer. Picking out the most important is sometimes difficult. They're all important, but I think the ones that I've been involved in more or less, to say from the start to the end, that I think are pretty salient. There's like the construction of the roads, some of the housing construction that I've been involved in, the computerization process, which I've been pretty heavily involved in, probably strike my mind is that, and the forestry project, I think last year, if you would ask me the question last year, that would have been the most salient project, because like forestry is a new, is relatively new in the community, and like I'm not saying forestry, you know, like the cutting trees and all that, but reforestation, like replanting trees and, you know, doing inventories and ensuring that whatever is there will be improved on, the value of the community's resources are to be improved in the future. That's basically what the forest management is, and that's a fairly new concept, and we get monies from year to year, not that much, but from the Canadian Forestry Service. And they're too relatively new dealing with communities, and they have very little understandings of a reserve setting. That the problems here are much different than the outside, and the people's attitudes and views on how things should be done. I think we encountered probably about 2 years ago, we lived through some very, very demanding situations where I think there was a general misunderstanding of the whole situation, is that we were getting limited dollars to undertake forestry activities, and we couldn't pay any more than what we were given. So basically, because if we pay more than what the government is allotting to us, we go in a deficit, and the band can't operate in a deficit, because if we pay out too much and we don't get enough, we have to eventually cover that deficit, and if you start doing that, it mounts and it mounts, and then you can't pay back. And there's a lot of communities in reserve communities in Quebec and in Canada that are in a bankruptcy situation where they've overexpended. So you have to draw the line, which is difficult, especially when it's your own people, you know, the people that you see every day, not only when you, not only in the office, but when you leave the office, you see these people. And the thing is that people have to understand is that, you know, it's not that we're trying to be bad guys or anything, but it's just part of the administration. You know, we can only do what with what we have, and we can't do more. So I think that's because, you know, when you're starting something new like forestry, it's difficult for people to understand. It's difficult when you're starting something new. And I think as time goes on, and it seems to be evident that things are falling into place.
You are in the process of computerizing the band's administration. When was this decision made?
We're in the process. Yeah, we've pretty well computerized there now. It's a big job. We're just about catching up to the whole, you know, like getting everything in line. This decision was made. I know when I came here, the chief was saying we got to computerize our operations, and I said, okay, well, I'll check into it. And that was roughly 3 years ago. So, you know, we got the system about 2.5 years ago, and we've been playing around with it since. And now we finally got in it full. Our feet are wet with it, and our hands are full with it. So there's no choice, there's no backing out now, that we have to go full tilt with it. It is a big step, and it's been a very demanding one, especially that since we've implemented, we started last March. We started we transferred our balances from the manual system into the computer, and we started operating from there. And then we implemented our payroll, and then our payables, and you know, and then we've been operating since then. But just recently, we took over, like I said, the school's administration in July, and that. Opening new balances and all the vendors, you know, the suppliers that had to be created, and you know, just the increased volume of work was tremendous. Like I said, we're slowly catching up, and not only that, the difficulty too is it's new. People don't understand it, and you know, there's frustration involved. But as time goes on, you know, people are learning. Our staff is learning. They're having the patience to deal with it, and things are coming along.
How successful have you been in implementing and teaching your employees the use of computers for financial and word processing purposes?
That's difficult to assess. I think when we first started implementing the system, there was a bit of resistance to it. But I think through persevering and getting it on and getting the balances in and starting to operate with it, and it's been employees have accepted it and realize it's here to stay, and they have to work with it. And I think the learning process, people are coming along, and things are being done more efficiently now. And like I say, they're accepting it, and I think things are going well. And as far as assessing the successfulness of implementing a system, I think at this point it's very difficult to say. I think I'd be more in a position to assess that, how successful it's been, probably in January. And at that point we will have almost completed a full year of operation, and the staff will have been trained and will be experienced with it. But from what I see now, I think things are on an upswing now, and I think that as the months go by, things will get better. And I don't know, I always have that optimism. Anyways, that's pretty well.
Do you feel that computerization will reduce the employee requirements for the band's administration?
I think as far as computerization goes, it doesn't reduce the employee requirements. I think more or less it puts more demand on the employee, because the employee has to know the system, has to know more, because you cannot take like someone who knows nothing about computers and say you're going to pay bills today, because they wouldn't be able to do it. There's a certain information requirements, like the employee has to know certain steps to be taken in order to post an invoice, to enter an invoice into the system, and also requires certain information to know how to pay an invoice from the system, or to run payroll, or to enter balances, and learning, you know, like learning word processing is also another, how to log on, how to log off the system. It more or less gives, I think, it develops the employee, because it makes them be able to, you know, makes them articulate in the system. Once they learn one system, the other systems, any other system is very similar. The procedures are all, you know, you've seen one, you pretty well can manage with another. But it's that whole learning process. And I think it more or less develops the employee and makes them more employable. It makes them computer literate also, which I think in this day and age, as everything is going to computerization, it's an important element.
Very interesting. Well, I thank you very much, Van, for being on our program Reserve Now. Tonight on Reserve Now, you heard Van McGregor speaking about band management. I would like to thank our guests for appearing on Reserve Now, and we hope you have enjoyed it. I'm Elmer Kamanda, bidding you all a good evening.
But for more recent coverage of Diane and her husband has been increasingly harsh. Last July, several tabloids alleged that Diana was embroiled in romantic relations with bachelor investment banker Philip Dunn, with whom she had been seen dancing at the June wedding ball of the Marquess of Worcester. And one of the Britain's top gossip columnists, the Daily Mail, reported that the princess spent a February weekend with Dunn and other guests at a family country estate, while Prince Charles and Diana's parents were out of the country. The controversy died down after Dunn issued a statement to his lawyers flatly denying an opportunity. Soon afterwards, Charles and Diana were seen together in a public, playfully snuggling and kissing at a polo match.
Partners and I will be opening up a consulting firm to negotiate self-government for different bands across the country. So I tend to lead a somewhat busy life.
So you intend to form your own law firm then?
No, there's a distinction actually between a law firm and a consulting firm or a lobbyist. A law firm is a very restrictive firm to be involved. It's a very restrictive business. You have to abide by so many rules. And I take both a professional and a personal viewpoint that if you want to advance in the area of Native affairs, Native policy, Native law, you don't go to court. Courts have a habit of restricting Aboriginal rights. Rather, if you want to make major advancements, you enter into political negotiations. In that way, everybody comes out a winner.
So you do intend to get involved in Canadian Native affairs or Native politics?
Yes. I can't say public policy holding as such. But rather, my whole interest is to help bands who have an interest in pursuing self-government to get them off the ground and to achieve that long road of being self-governing. And that's why, actually, I tend to concentrate all of my studies at school towards that subject. It's a very complicated deal, but it can be achieved if one takes their time.
You. going on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you. And you, I'll tell you this, I know the things that your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by, them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they
Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young with Teach Your Children. I asked a third-year law student, Sammy Ojek, about the upcoming referendum on the Kitigan Zibi's land claims. Are you aware of the upcoming referendum on the land claim negotiations being held between the reserve here and the Department of Indian Affairs?
I'm somewhat aware of it. I don't know the details. Not only do I go to school full-time, but I work full-time, so I tend to be somewhat removed from the daily happenings of the reserve. Whatever I can get hold of, it's through by hearsay only or secondary knowledge. Yeah, so I am aware of some of the aspects, but not everything.
And on the same subject, is a federal government negotiator dealing in native land claims as supposed to be a qualified lawyer?
Not necessarily. A negotiator could be a lawyer. He could be a political scientist. He could be a public administrator. He could be a land evaluator. But preferably, most negotiators are lawyers, because the art of negotiation is a practice of in itself. Not too many people could do it. There are so many rules that a negotiator has to abide by that normally the client is not aware of. And the whole idea is to avoid an impasse and to achieve a successful result at the end. So, yes, in law schools they do teach you how to negotiate properly. Because if a land claim is agreed to, it eventually has to go to the Department of Justice, which is basically run by lawyers anyways. And so they have the final approval of approval to the land claim itself before it's given recognition within the House. So yes, eventually what's happened is the land claim is manipulated by lawyers.
Moving on to a slightly different area, would you be available for legal consultations if someone from this reserve requested it?
It depends on what you mean, legal consultations. One has to remember as well, our reserve is located in Quebec, and Quebec is run by civil law. It's a codified law, whereas I've been studying common law for the last couple of years. It's a totally different aspect altogether. I would be available for consultations in the area of native law because it does apply to Quebec. It's a federal matter. But when it comes down to the very specifics of Quebec civil law, that's outside of my jurisdiction altogether. And that would include, for example, a landlord and tenant within the Quebec law, contract law, property law. There are all sorts of various things that are different within Quebec that are not the same in Ontario.
What advice would you give to native students who wish to pursue a career in law, or any career for that matter?
the ultimate question. I think this is one question I am quite well prepared for. My advice to students is basically don't give up. Don't let nothing and no one stand in your way. There are so very few Native status Indian students in law schools right now across the country. And what's happening is law schools all over the country are playing a numbers game whereby they would like to get as many a number of Native students into law schools and get them to graduate and go out. But law school is difficult and it's also easy. There are some courses that are hard and there's some that are easy. Like I said before, I don't consider myself a greatly intelligent student. I think there are many people on the reserve who are probably more intelligent than I am. And my philosophy is basically, if I can do it, I think anybody else back home could do it. So it's just a matter of disciplining yourself to get down to work and do a lot of hard work.
Did you attend the prep law course being held in Saskatchewan?
Yes. Yes, that was quite some time ago.
And that is a two-month course, is it?
It's a rigorous two-month course. It's designed to gear Native students easy access into law schools, but I worked with the Department of Justice into evaluating that program, I'd say about 4 years ago, and it's a very unusual program. I certainly recommend any student who's thinking of going into law school to take it because it gives them a very good view of what law school is like, and it tells them in a very quick period of time whether they are right for law school. But that course adds on a lot more difficulty on any student. If you're a non-native student, if you want to get into law school, you basically have to have very high marks and a high law school admission test score. Those are basically the two requirements. But if you're an Indian student, you have to have, again, high marks, your law school admission test score, and a fairly good assessment from the University of Saskatchewan. So there's more of a heavier onus on Native students to go into law school. It wasn't designed that way, but unfortunately it is. So again, really, the key is if a student wants to study law, they probably would know way beforehand what's perfect for them. And again, I can only emphasize that one has to work hard to get what they want. It doesn't come easy.
Right. I've always had that impression about the profession of law.
Well, it's not all that difficult, like I say, and most of us do, certainly most of my friends at school do work full-time as well, and I think it really boils down to just disciplining your lifestyle altogether. There are times when you can't really go partying or anything like that. It's making sure that you do your work by the hours. You have to watch your days go by, the hours per day. Most people I know are doing their law degree and another university degree at the same time and are also working their way through school. So, yes, it's easy and yet it's hard.
Which law school would you, in your own personal opinion, consider to be the best in Canada?
That's a difficult question. I'm going to take that from the viewpoint of a Native student. What do they want to do? If they want to practice Native law, certainly the best schools are University of Saskatchewan, University of BC, and probably Osgoode Hall, because they have excellent professors who teach native law. Ottawa U is also a good one. Our professor has done a lot of work in the field, but the difficulty with Ottawa U is that they emphasize that their students practice law. As a result, I think that 75% of your courses are not related to native law altogether. They're related to, say, corporate law, tax law, finance, things that will make you work out to the field with non-native people. If you're studying at Queen's, Toronto, or in Vancouver for that matter, you have a greater choice of what you want to do. It really depends on what the student wants to do. But certainly, I should say that shopping for university can be difficult. It requires a lot of forethought. And I'd like to make myself available to any student who is considering studies of law and helping them through that thick forest.
And how many years does it take to become a qualified lawyer?
Basically, most law schools require you to do a BA, which is about 3 years first, but you can get into a law school with just 2 years of formal educational training. But I would suggest that you do your full 3 years, because it's always good to have a BA, and then it's another 3 years on top for law school. If you want to practice altogether, it's another year after your 3 years of law, which gives you up to 7 so far. You have to do your articles, in other words, it's a form of apprenticeship where you're sent to a law firm or else the Supreme Court. In my case, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to be clerking with the Navajo Supreme Court. And then you have to write your bar ads for 6 months. But there's a choice. Your bar admission course you have to write your exams for 6 months straight. But you have that choice of doing your Master of Laws, another degree, and not having to write your exam. Your Master of Laws could take you about another 2 to 5 years altogether. There's no ending. It could take you anywhere from 3 years to, say, 7 or 8 years. But the whole idea is basically, there's a trend now that having a simple law degree is not enough. There are a lot of lawyers out there who are in competition with each other. There's not enough clients for the lawyers existing. So what's happening is most lawyers are going for their third degree or fourth degree for that matter. And so the competition is lessened in that sense. So I do find myself, yes, still continuing to go to school after this.
Well, that is very good to hear. And Sammy, I would like to thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy, I know you have a very busy schedule, to give us a call here, and we appreciate this very, very much.
Well, actually, I should be thanking you. It gives me a good break from having to study somewhat of a boring subject, that being tax law. So I should be the one to thank you. You've afforded me somewhat of a different break.
You're very welcome.
Oh, well, thank you.
So, possibly sometimes we'll run into each other on the reserve here.
Yes. Well, I hope to make it very soon.
Yeah, okay. And maybe we could, go out and have a drink and talk law.
Hopefully not. You will find out exactly how boring a student's life can be.
Okay, Sammy. So I hope to be seeing you in the very near future.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Highway, there was a girl hitchhiking with the dog. Fireflies buzzing round her head like candles in the fog. He was 3 miles down the road trying to stay up, but he knew that he couldn't. She was looking for a ride through the night, but out there who wouldn't? They were bound for glory, bound for love. living on the edge. They were bound for each other like two comets heading for a bed. She had a new way of living, new way of looking at life. He had an 84 International and two kids he left back home with his wife. Was tired of writing letters to himself and living in the dark. She was open to suggestions, and some say she had a broken heart. He had everything he wanted till it all turned out to be a job. One faller, sleep trucker, and a girl hitchhiking with a dog. They were bound for glory, bound for living on the edge. They were bound for each other like two comets heading for a bed. She had a new way of living, new way of looking at life. He had an 84 International and two kids he left back home with his wife. By the time it hit the window, they were waking up from what little sleep they had. When that heat hit the blanket, they were looking for love at second sight. Just staring in each other's eyes, finding it in the morning light. They were bound for glory, bound for living on the edge. They were bound for each other like two blankets laying on the bed. She had a new way of living, new way of looking at life. Had an 84 International and two kids he left back home with his wife.
Neil Young there with Bound for Glory. Sammy Ojek, third-year law student at Ottawa University. If you would like more information on Mr. Ojek and his law studies, contact CKWE at 449-5097. Once again, we wrap up another edition of Reserve Now, CKWE's public affairs show. If you have any suggestions for topics to be discussed over the air, please let us know. I'm Jimmy Ojek, and I can say thanks for listening. Reserve Now has been a CKWE Public Affairs production.